TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Fast Food World. The Indian physicist and seed collector Vandana Shiva has dedicated her life to biodiversity. Eric Schlosser's first book, Fast Food Nation, has already been translated into over 20 languages. Both were part of an amazing panel on fast food that included slow food founder Carlo Petrini from Italy, Michael Pollan, author of The Botany of Desire, and the Kentucky farmer and poet Wendell Berry. In this part two of a three-part program, Vandana Shiva and Eric Schlosser make their 8-minute statements. Schlosser brings up McDonald's scary slogan, One Taste Worldwide. Both focus on the impact of global trade on agriculture. Here is Vandana Shiva on the ancient spice gardens of India.
Long before the first globalization based global trade on slavery, we had genuinely free international trade. My country was among the leaders in it. India was exporting spices long before the Europeans thought they should colonize the world to control the spice trade. And of course, they landed here thinking they were coming to India. But it was only trade in spice. And I worked on those farms, the spice gardens in southern India and the Western Ghats. Each farm will only cultivate 1/10 of its land with spice gardens. The rest will be rice. And the rice is not even exported to the rest of the country. The spice gardens are supported with 10 times the area of forest, so the spice gardens became major conservation zones. And during colonialism, we had huge conflicts because the British wanted to convert those forests, they're called better lands, into timber mines. And the farmers said, no, these are the base of sustenance of these farms. These spice gardens have existed as long as history can be recorded. They have become unviable now because globalization is leading to a collapse of prices in spice gardens of the same 50% that Mexican farmers are experiencing due to dumping of grain. And I think that really is at the heart of the new globalization. The last globalization also had a free trade treaty. I'm sure most of you never heard of it. It was called the Farrukh Shir Farman with the Right Honorable East India Company, 1716. Exactly the same rules as NAFTA, same rules as WTO, same rules that basically say punish the local economy and reward the global predator. Change the entire system so that those who pirate and trade do well and those who do honest business disappear. We got rid of that one through our freedom movement. We also with it drove away hunger because hunger was a very important legacy of a system of farming that forced Indian peasants to grow indigo and did not allow them to grow food. Indian peasants had to grow during the American Revolution when cotton couldn't be supplied from here. Our farmers had to grow cotton for exports, couldn't grow food. No one did that willingly. No farmer wanted to only grow export crops. The famine that we had, 2 million people killed in 1940, led to a major rebellion, revolt, rethinking. We got freedom, we got rid of hunger. We redistributed land, and I think miraculously became the only society in the contemporary world that made the rural areas viable for 75% of our population. There is no other part of the world where 750 million people make a living in agriculture. And yet that 750 million people's livelihoods and lives are threatened because of a new trade system, which I believe is based on two totally illegitimate principles. The first is the principle of the right to dump, which is sell below the cost of production. And I agree with Michael, it's not just about subsidies. Because anyway, subsidies given to farmers to grow for the domestic market don't hurt farmers in another region. It's subsidies linked to reducing prices and then selling the product overseas under a condition where you don't have a right to prevent that kind of import because of the removal of import restrictions and all the laws on market access in the WTO agreement. So it ends up being a right to dump. Right to dump now at 50% across commodities below the cost of production. That's what free trade rules are about. And the second, I would call the right to force feed, is the right that is being exercised through WTO rules to force Indians to stop eating food cooked with their edible oils and only eat food cooked with palm oil. I believe it was not meant to be an edible oil, or GM soya oil. And I can't go into details in these 10 minutes of how that was achieved. Or the more recent dispute introduced against the European Union in the WTO by the United States government to say the Europeans don't have a right to say no to genetically engineered food, or now, after August, don't even have a right to regulate the GM imports with labeling, segregation, and traceability laws. These are force-feeding laws. So the combination of false prices and forced feeding, in my view, doesn't lead to free trade. It leads to forced trade. And that is the real problem with the free trade agreements. They are about forcing trade on unwilling producers and unwilling consumers, and using trade instruments as a coercive measure, which is why there was rebellion in Cancun, which is why recently the FTEA had to remove agriculture from negotiations. I would count that as a failure of FTEA. It's just that they didn't allow it to be announced as that, because agriculture is a very major element of why these larger free trade areas are needed. These rules are emerging very clearly as true rules of vicious globalization. Virtuous globalization can only be based on localization first. First, because food, unlike anything else, needs the soil, the biodiversity, the water, and unless we conserve those, we are never, ever going to have virtuous production. Secondly, if we cannot maintain farmers on the land and guarantee livelihoods through robust local economies, we are not going to have virtuous trade. Thirdly, if we have to enrich each other's lives through adding of diversity and quality, we have to ensure that that quality and diversity is maintained where it belongs, in local cultures and local ecosystems. And that is why global trade can only be supportive of ecologically sustainable agriculture, local production, with leftovers reaching global markets. Leftovers reaching global markets on fair trade principles, just prices, and mutual giving and taking between consumers and producers. I think it's that mutuality that is going to create the new partnerships that will bring the agriculture and farm movement and food movement at the heart of the ecology movement. And we know the ecology movement is in need for life support. And here's the opportunity. But it is not just the ecology movement that needs life support, because the real subsidies that are distorting the trading system are subsidies that aren't going to farmers, they're going to cheap oil, they're the subsidies that allow wars to happen, they're the subsidies that allow the entire plant material of the planet to belong to one or two companies. Intellectual property rights is a huge hidden subsidy. Paying farmers less than what it has cost them to produce, whether it is through direct income support, no matter what the trick used to buy below cost of production, that is a subsidy. And those don't come directly from governments. Those come from corporations, ripping off the farmer and society then bearing the cost somehow in ill health, dispossessed farmers, and disappearing rural communities. I think We need rural communities everywhere in the world. Support to local agriculture anywhere in the world needs to be strengthened. What we need to see disappear is the distortions in pricing. If we can just hang on there on the demand for just prices and just trade and keep working in all kinds of creative ways, some people in changing the trade rules, others just building local organic markets, others just celebrating food as the ultimate cultural creation of humanity, I think we will very soon be able to fill the vacuum left after the failure of Cancun in a creative way. I think we are being called on to create the new world order, and it will look very different from the present one.
It's true that white men came to this country looking for spices. And it's also true that there would not be a United States if there wasn't a trade dispute over dumping. And it was the same British East India Company that was dumping tea at a very low price onto the American market. And it really angered the tea distributors on the East Coast. And that was really the beginning of the United States. So globalization, and particularly the global trade in agricultural goods, is as old as mankind. But the question is, what are the terms of that trade, and who is benefiting from it? Now, when there was a British Empire, the British Empire benefited profoundly from it. And when they followed a mercantilist policy, they used their colonies as sources of raw material that they would exploit. But once it was in their interest, and once they had a very strong manufacturing base, they turned to, quote, free trade, unquote, because it was in their interest. Again and again, you see the terms of world trade being dictated by the dominant world power. The only free trade there is right now, I would argue, is that you are free to give large sums of money to the Republican Party, and in return, you will be able to trade. So when you're talking about this global trade in agriculture, or you're talking about the world economic system and how it's been transformed in the last 20 years, what you're talking about is a centralization of corporate power and a growth in corporate power. And I don't come to this in a narrowly anti-corporate way, but I am opposed to the unbridled corporate power that we now see in the world. And it is of enormous importance when it comes to food. It may just be irritating when it comes to music, but when it comes to food, it has profound importance because there is no other industry without food. Food is the bedrock of our civilization, and as Wendell has written about for years, it is the determinant of the physical landscape and the cultural landscape. And I think that we have to look at the product that is being pushed onto the world as a form of pollution. It is a form of pollution that is polluting not just the landscape through these gigantic factory farms, through genetically modified organisms that we have no idea what the consequences are going to be for generations. But it's also a pollution of our culture and of our society, this centralized, uniform, corporate culture that I would argue is the antithesis of freedom. It's the antithesis of anything that Adam Smith ever envisaged. And it's much closer to corporate socialism. And when you look at where those subsidies are going, and not just the farm subsidies going to agribusiness, but the enormous subsidies that are given to the oil companies, we will fight wars for them, we will send our young to die for them. This is a cost too high to pay. So I would argue that this cheap food is much, much too expensive for our culture. Now, I wrote about McDonald's. McDonald's a few years ago had a slogan that I found telling and chilling, and their slogan was, "One taste worldwide." Now, all you need to do is draw a little mustache on Ronald, and you get a sense of what that ideology ultimately means. And we have dealt for the last 100 years with one ideology after another that's trying to impose uniformity and conformity. And what everyone on this panel is arguing for is the antithesis, which is a respect for diversity, a respect for regional identity.
That was Eric Schlosser, author of Fast Food Nation. He and Vandana Shiva were on a panel on fast food at UC Berkeley. The moderator of the panel was the author and former rancher, Orville Schell, dean of the Department of Journalism at UC Berkeley. Now the conversation begins. The Kentucky poet and farmer Wendell Berry engages Vandana Shiva.
I want to ask Vandana, how were the standards of quality enforced in the traditional old communities of India?
Well, I remember my father, who is no more, eating a meal and saying, "No, I can't eat the curry today. The tomatoes have pesticide." And I think the best standards of quality were maintained by recognizing that the body is the best measure of quality. I think this is what Carla was meaning about not there being no interpreter. The problem is industrialization of food has meant industrialization of our bodies and therefore a desensitization to quality. I look at it in two ways. The first is, all living cultures and all human societies have recognized quality as the best measure of knowing what's in the world. In India, we talk about 5 knowledge systems, you know, the knowing through the ear, the knowing through the smell, the knowing through the taste. Those are all knowings. But the Cartesian revolution got rid of quality as being measurable, even though we had ways of measuring quality. And primary qualities were reduced to the totally constructed ones. Yeah, the size of this table, the weight, the size of this. And then we could keep increasing the size and saying we are increasing quantity. But we've defined quantity as the first quality and the only quality, and everything else was unreliable quality. And I was doing a workshop in a village on agriculture, organic farming, GMOs, etc. And a little girl in a village school said, "Why are they so crazy? They want to harvest all of the mangoes in one season as one mango that doesn't give us more mangoes." She could see it, that one bigger mango is not more mangoes. So I really feel the issue is not so much quality versus quantity, but quantity embedded in a matrix of quality, which gives us the real living relationship with the land, with the food. Now, the Mayan farms in Oaxaca are growing 20 tons of food, except that the food is jackfruit and banana and beans, etc., and 2 tons of corn. So the 2 tons of corn is made to look like less than the 4 tons of corn. But I can have a bet, if you do a trace analysis of micronutrients, those 2 tons of corn, which have better quality and better taste, also have more nutrients. And recently, when we were together in Naples for the Slow Food Congress, I did mention that the trap of quantity alone without quality is getting us into the obesity trap.
Well, here's a question addressed to Michael Pollan, but I think it is all panelists might want to take a crack at it. Do you think that we have changed the carrying capacity of the Earth through fossil fuels to the extent that we could not support the current population with organic agriculture free of synthetic fertilizers?
That is a very hard and scary question. When I've done research on nitrogen fertilizer, which in a way is the key 20th century invention driving the whole industrialization of food, is the fact that we learned how to turn fossil fuel into food for our plants. I learned that there are 2 billion people on this planet whose very substance was made is nitrogen that came from those fertilizers. So whether we can undo that is a real question. That is the limiting factor in so much agriculture and therefore in so much population is the this limitation on the nitrogen in our soil. And we've exceeded that artificially. Now, there is a margin. Wes Jackson says there's a kind of margin for error because we're feeding so much food to animals. And I think if we truly went to organic and we could eliminate all the fertility we're giving to our cattle, it might help. But I don't think it's at all clear that going to a completely organic agriculture as we now know it could support a population of 8 billion.
Anyone else have a thought on that? Wendell?
Well, the first thing to say in reply to that question, I think, is that we don't know right now. We're probably going to find out. But to talk about dependence on industrial agriculture that we now have is, once we understand it, to propose that we've become dependent on a form of agriculture that finally is going to starve everybody. So whether we can feed everybody for a while with this kind of farming or not is a kind of quibble. We've got to hope that we have some kind of margin for change. If the government decided right now to change to a more conservative kind of agriculture, we couldn't do it in this country very fast because we don't have the people to do it, and we don't have the knowledge, we don't have the skill, we don't have the local cultures that can sustain this kind of work. We had those cultures half a century ago, 40 years ago. We could have this would have been a much more thinkable thing than it is now. But you can't simply pull the farmers you need out of the labor pool as you would for factory work or other industrial work. To have good farming, you have to know have people who know how to do it, and we just don't have them, and we're not saving the ones we have.
That was Wendell Berry. Here is Vandana Shiva.
I don't know the farms in Iowa. Never been there, never seen them. But I have studied the Green Revolution in India, which is the introduction of fossil fuel inputs, whether as nitrogen as fertilizers or mechanization. And in fact, that's what started me off on spending my time and life on food issues, because at the end of studying the violence in Punjab in the 80s, 84, 85, it became very clear that we hadn't produced more food on the land in Punjab. We had produced more rice and wheat. But we had produced more rice and wheat by getting rid of all the oil seeds, all the pulses, all the greens that were also part of food, but they were never taken into account in the food basket. So I would say the fact that the calculations have always been done with respect to the monocultures of 5 globally traded commodities and then generating the artificial surpluses in those commodities does not mean more food is being grown per unit resource use. I believe less food is being grown per unit resource use, and the units of resource use are land, biodiversity, and water. We're actually using 10 times more water to grow the same amount of food. So we are mining the planet for water just to dissolve those extra chemicals. The plants don't need that excess water. The chemicals need it. And I also know beyond a point, you cannot keep pumping synthetic fertilizers into the soil and have the plant take it up, because what helps the plant take up nutrients is the living organisms in the soil. So chemicals have no direct relationships with the plants. And the fact that we extrapolate very conveniently to say, you know, this much more addition of nutrients. In Punjab, the productivity and yield is declining totally, because now the soils are absolutely saturated with synthetic fertilizers, which have killed the original creators of fertility. So I would basically say we need to move from monoculture calculations to biodiversity calculations. And I think in terms of biodiversity, ecological farms using biodiversity, not just monoculture organic farms, I think those will stay impoverished. But biodiverse farms using land, water, and biodiversity efficiently, and having biodiversity not just as an input, but as an output, that output is much higher than any industrial farm can produce. And that, I think, is a biological fact.
That was Vandana Shiva, Indian physicist, seed collector, feminist, and author of Monoculture of the Mind. She spoke on a panel on fast food that included Wendell Berry, Eric Schlosser, Michael Pollan, and Carlo Petrini. They were recorded at UC Berkeley just before Thanksgiving 2003. Their animated conversation continued for another half hour, so this is a rare 90-minute, three-part program on fast food. Join us for the next broadcast of TUC Radio. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can get information how to order a copy of the complete three-part program of Fast Food World by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.